Welcome to Rust Belt Science. I'm your host, Maggie Fink.
And I'm Shahir Rizk.
Today we have a very special guest with us. We have Lygia Cueva, who is a postdoctoral researcher at Cornell University. And you are in the astronomy department, correct?
Or, yeah.
Yeah. So, but you are also a biologist.
Yes, that's true.
So this is very exciting to have you here. Right. Talk to us about outer space and then my favorite thing, microbiology, and what that means for life on other planets.
Right. We love microbiology.
We do love microbiology.
We love bacteria and all little things.
I'm a little terrified of outer space. But if you bring microbiology, then it's a little bit more palatable.
I actually have a friend who's terrified of space as well. She's afraid of going to planetariums.
Oh, really?
Wow. Yeah.
I
it is a phobia.
I think I have it. Because it's just the vastness of it. It's that and deep ocean.
I think deep ocean is scarier.
I agree.
To me, it is scarier because I don't know how to swim. Oh. And I know how that sounds coming from Portugal. I don't know how I survived it. But I guess if you actually go to a beach in Portugal, you will understand why I don't know how to swim. They are terrifying. That's why people go do big wave surfing there. Because that's not the place for you to learn how to swim.
That's very true. Also, the water there, I was actually in Portugal several years ago. The water there is cold. It's very cold.
It is the Atlantic Ocean. It's not the Mediterranean Sea. But that also means we have great fish, great gastronomy, as opposed to, I'm joking.
Excellent food, for sure. Excellent food, amazing food.
Yes. So the first thing we actually like to ask our guests before we get into all the fun science is, are you reading, listening to, or watching anything interesting, non-science related, for fun?
Oh, great. So I am a major bookworm. I'm currently reading The Thursday Night Murder Club. I think that's the name.
The Thursday Night Murder Club.
Yes, which is a club composed by elderly people in a that are living in a retirement home. And we have an ex-MI6 that is retired. And a psychiatrist someone from the Labour Party in the UK, like also retired, something like that, but he's a major West Ham fan. Anyway, it's a great whodunit book, but at the same time with a lot of British humor. And I'm a big fan of it. It's already the fourth book.
So highly recommend.
Yes, I think it's written by Richard Osmond. I'm awful with names, but I think that's the name.
Okay.
Excellent. We'll add that to our list.
Yeah, that's like you're one of the first who actually had a non-science answer. Most people are like, well, I've been watching a documentary or listening to a podcast about science.
So that's work for me. That's not after work for me.
Exactly. All right. Excellent. Excellent. On to some science now. I hear astrobiology and I understand those two words. I understand astronomy and biology. But astrobiology, what does that encompass? Can you kind of define what that is for you and maybe the field more broadly for our listeners who might not know?
So astrobiology is a multidisciplinary science, meaning that you don't have a straight path of studies that you have to do to actually do it as your profession later on. You can start it as a biologist, as a chemist, you can do physics, you can even take a medical degree. What is important in astrobiology is that your research focuses in one of three questions. What is the origin of life? What is the future of the planet? What is the future of life? How does it end? Mm-hmm. And is there life elsewhere in the universe? If your research somehow touches one of these topics or questions, you are doing astrobiology.
Wow.
And usually people don't just do astrobiology, right? Mm-hmm. Because this connects maybe with searching for diversity in the ocean, in the atmosphere, understanding metabolism, even cancer. Mm-hmm. What drove me to astrobiology as well was how, when I was doing cancer research, I understood very early on that we are very bottlenecked in our knowledge of cells and how how cancer cells come to be. And a lot of these, I believe, we will understand if we answer these fundamental questions. Because we might find the planet B that it's in the early stages of life, then we understand the origin of life. Mm. We might find the planet B that is in the same stage as Earth, but it has different life forms. And we might understand the limitations of cells and the other, or what real molecules are the key fundamental requirements for life. Or we might find the planet B that it's in late stage of the presence of life in the surface or in the water, and that may make us understand why life comes to be at all in an environment. So it might be that life exists on the planet simply because that planet needs to release energy very fast. Right. For instance, thermodynamically speaking, it might be that's the reason because with catabolism, catalysis. Well, it's part. Catabolism does have catalysis.
Lots of catalysis.
I just want a note for the people that are listening. This is after 5 p.m.
This is true. And you've had a very long day.
Yes. So catalysis makes chemistry goes very fast, right? Mm-hmm. Life depends on that.
Right.
And that may be what a planet have to develop or evolve. It might be just part of simple nature of a planet if that planet needs to release energy very fast.
Right.
So if we find a planet B, that might be actually our conclusion, a very fundamental reason for life.
Right.
We are just as much as rocks on the planet, right? It might be just that. But while rocks have a different thermodynamics and planets that don't need to just spend that energy very fast, maybe just we'll have the rocks. Life may be, how do you say, like a symptom of a different type of thermodynamics. It might be something like that. I don't know. It's just, you know, one of the big questions. Could this be the reason? A planet B in whatever stage would actually help us with life, would actually help us solve a lot of our mysteries.
So the idea here is that life could be one way of moving energy from like high energy to low energy.
Exactly. Entropy, basically.
Right.
Yes.
And we're just passing
releasing entropy. So feeding on free energy and releasing entropy very fast.
Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've heard some of this, some of these ideas before. It's just that life essentially is getting rid of a gradient. So you have high energy on one side, low energy on one side, and the high energy needs to go to the low energy because that's essentially what happens. Everything goes to equilibrium, and life is just one way to shortcut that.
So actually, this brings that's very interesting. And who started that was Schrödinger and Ward Kelvin.
Right.
A long time ago. Mm-hmm. And this was the time where physicists did biology and biologists did chemistry, and the time where they only had a textbook for each. That we didn't have enough knowledge that you needed different fields, and kind of they had their own field, but they could write papers about the other fields, right? They could have all the knowledge more or less in one person. Now that's not possible. And so we need to collaborate.
Right.
We need physicists to collaborate with chemists and with biologists. And so Schrödinger wrote a book, which is What is Life?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't read it. I read the papers, not the book. And the paper, and Ward Kelvin also has a paper on this, where he was hypothesizing that life didn't follow the second law of thermodynamics, which is the entropy law. Entropy basically is what you pay in the tolls with energy. Like every time you pass from one state to another state, you have to pay some energy that will never come back to you.
Right. Mm-hmm. You don't break even.
Exactly. Yeah. It will always be lost. Mm-hmm. And that basically it's a state of organization, more or less. It's like if you have a room that is organized and you pass into a state of the organization, it's very unlikely that you will bring it back to the original state,
right,
unless you spend a lot of energy. So it's very messy. But it's a good way to start thinking about life. So he was not right at the beginning when he said it didn't follow. It does follow if we think about life as an open system, which it is. But it actually stirred the conversation of how to look at life as energy, not only as a body of cells. Or if you look at just thermodynamically, there's a lot we can unpick. And unpack. It's after 5 p.m. Okay. um, so So that it's actually one of the approaches I take when I'm teaching Origin of Life to physicists and astronomers, because if you talk energy with them, they get it.
They understand it. Yeah. And the same rules that govern a falling object, same thing that life follows. It's just in a different form. So the same idea of free energy, entropy, all of that applies.
Yeah, exactly. And if a planet is really holding a lot of free energy that needs releasing, will that planet need a lot of rocks or a lot of life? Mm-hmm. It will need a lot of life, right? And you might, obviously, this is not premeditated, and I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that if the conditions are there for a lot of free energy to be consumed and released, then maybe that's the right setup for life to originate, and maybe that has something to do with it.
That life is just a good way, one
to
way,
just release.
One way to do that.
Yeah.
Excellent.
I have never heard some of these ideas before. This is not... I'm just kind of sitting here watching the two of you talk about this, and it's like a very... Listeners can't hear me, but up here or see me. Sorry, it's after five. idea of thinking about life and the origin of life. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting to ponder. But you specifically in your research are thinking about bacteria or microbes in some form as the way to, it's kind of like the benchmark for life, I feel like. And other planets, because we think we all, bacteria were the first living organisms. Or we think anyway. So how does the world of microbiology begin to interact with these questions about the origin of life and how we look for life on other planets?
Well, actually, so I started as a microbiologist, and I'm not going to go into my life story to answer this question. It's just, it's really relevant.
You can, you totally can.
So I, in my high school, I had to pick a degree for then university. And in Portugal, you don't get into university with all the courses that you can major on. You have to pick either the university for engineering or the university of medicine. And so I applied to astronomy and to biology. And I got in both, but biology was in Lisbon, which was closer by, and it was hard to pay to move to another city. And astronomy was in Porto, which is in another city. So I ended up in biology because of that, and not in astronomy to begin with. And in my first day of class, we studied these invisible organisms. It was like a microbiology classic 101. And I was immediately just sucked in into how amazing it is. And immediately I also start thinking, oh my God, this for sure connects with space. Because bacteria are winning in our planet. It's not us. Okay, if you think about evolution, they've been here for much more than us.
Right.
People say it's not complex life. Oh, but it is. And it's highly evolved life. We are the ones that are very, very basic.
For sure.
Finally, somebody is.
Somebody agrees.
Agrees with me.
It's not complex life. When we talk about humans, it's just big life, but not complex. We are just bags of bacteria. We are, what is the ratio now? 2-to-1, 3-to-1 times more bacterial cells in our bodies than human cells.
Right.
So immediately for me, that was, okay, this is where the questions are going to lead us. We are going to have to find microbial life in other planets or try to find. And so I should definitely stick around this microbiology field if I ever want to, you know, think about astrobiology. But that was always in the back of my mind also because it's not something that a student in Portugal dreamed about doing, at least back in the dark ages where those things didn't exist. So the connection, at least for people that, you know, are aficionado of that type of topics, I think it's immediate. And now with so much work done, I think we proved the concept. We should definitely be looking for biosignatures of microbes in the solar system and beyond, because they are just so diverse. They sustain so much stress. They survive so many things that you just think about the stress in space, and I'm like, there's a microbe that survives that.
Of course.
Fine. We're good.
So we're quite fragile. And we're very wimpy. We don't even have a cell wall.
Yeah.
we're barely keeping ourselves together. I know I'm barely keeping myself together, and it's like a Tuesday.
I know. We just had to walk across a cold campus in coats and hats and gloves.
I'm done.
And
we're
the products I put on the barrier we have, the skin?
Yeah.
It starts with a primer and then it starts with an hydrating cream.
Yeah. Vitamin E.
Yeah.
So hear me out. You said that there's more bacteria on our bodies, right? Mm-hmm. Then it's like 2 to 1 or something like that. What if bacteria really just are raising us?
Yeah.
So you proposed this idea.
Did I propose this before?
To me at some point.
Yeah, I'm sure I did.
So if you ask a gut microbiologist, they'll say, yeah, that's happening.
Right.
Because basically what they're doing is signaling your brain about things.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So there's this study on the Portuguese Institute called Champollion, and they study gut microbiome. And they found out there is a connection between our taste and the gut bacteria. So basically, they're even telling us what to like so that we eat what they want. I mean, this is already far-fetched. They couldn't prove as much.
Yeah.
And this was in Drosophila.
But that's great because when we die, they eat us. So it's
exactly.
They live on us. And then when we die, they eat us.
They're going to win.
That's perfect.
I remember hearing, when I was younger, before I even was a scientist, this idea that, well, there's probably life on other planets, but it's like not real life because it's probably a bacteria. And now I'm like, that's the coolest life that could be on another planet.
That's the most real life.
And they're, we have extremophiles here on Earth of bacteria that can survive in these crazy environments that we would never have imagined that we could sample something and there's living things in there. So it makes sense that on these planets that have such extreme temperatures and atmospheric, chemicals and all these things, that bacteria would be or some form of microbial life would be able to form there.
You are touching such a sensitive spot on astrobiology, which is a lot of research is still very anthropocentric. Like, let's work for oxygen. Well, now it's also oxygen is becoming very relevant also for looking for microbes because it's a signature of photosynthesis, oxygenic photosynthesis. But there's a lot of people looking for magnetic field, planets with magnetic fields.
Oh.
Why? Because that will protect life from radiation. Oh, and I'm like, what about the National Reserve in Chernobyl? What about humans? We survived. I haven't been there, fortunately. But some humans survived Chernobyl. Some humans survived the atomic bombs.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's an LD50, right? That even humans that are sensitive. But what about all the organisms that are like, what? Gamma rays? That's nice. That's just a walk in the park for me.
Yeah.
I can correct my DNA. Every 5 minutes, I'm good. There's microbes like that.
Mm-hmm.
So a magnetic field, I wouldn't say it's a requirement. Maybe for humans, a planet with humans. And I'm like, but who wants that?
Who wants that? More people?
Not me.
No, thanks.
I'm good with the people I know.
Give me bacteria.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a very human-centric way of... I mean, what else can we do? That's who we are, what we know. But... I want to talk a little bit more about your research, but I'm kind of like directions.
This is so cool.
But one of the things I really wanted to hear you talk about more is this idea of imagination in science. And I've listened to a couple of your talks on YouTube, and then you gave a talk today at Notre Dame as well. Imagination in science, it's just something that's not really kind of beat out of us in a way that just focus on the data and don't imagine what could be, because that's a useless endeavor for a scientist. I think in your field, it's more encouraged because there is so much of a lack of concrete evidence for things.
Mm-hmm.
And I just found it really inspiring to hear you talk about that and the role of imagination in your work. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that more and how you think it should be applied to other areas of research that aren't quite as literally out there as astrobiology.
So I wouldn't say it's encouraged. I think it's silently encouraged and just appreciated when it actually happens.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's still a science, and so we still have this way of behaving like we have to be very, data driven, which I am.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to be very objective,
mm-hmm.
which obviously I also am. and we should be in science, or I try to be, let's say, mm-hmm. like we as humans are always a bit subjective, but mm-hmm. I try to do that in my data, in my work. Mm-hmm. But imagination, it's something we try to remove from kids in STEM. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe you have to stop being imaginative to being objective. Mm-hmm. So that you can be objective. Mm-hmm. I think they can both exist in your brain.
Yeah.
And especially, and I don't think it's just for astrobiology, for drug discovery, for any realm of science that requires innovation, mm-hmm. you cannot do it without imagination.
Sure.
And you shouldn't be doing it in silence or in like secretly, like mm-hmm. I'm imagining, like in then creating whatever story it is that's why I come up with this. Mm-hmm. It was mm-hmm. definitely not during my shower last night. It was because I read all these papers.
Right.
There's no reason for that. The best questions, the best fundamental questions, are always made by children.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Why are plants green?
Yeah.
We don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How is that a bad question? Why are we beating out these questions from kids?
Well, they're wonderful questions.
Well, we are not beating out the questions. I mean, hopefully nobody's doing that. Oh my God.
Figuratively.
It's not my first language and he's after five. Yeah. What I mean is that why are we killing this imagination in school? Mm-hmm. We should teach it. We should teach to use it as a superpower we can control.
Right.
Imagination is beautiful if you apply in your creative, in the creative steps of your work. The work needs steps of creation, conceptualization. You need imagination for that. But then you have your data. Your imagination has to stop. You have to stop using your ideas that were preceding the data. You have to look at it as in the most objective way and just look at the truth. Mm-hmm. And then to explain this truth, there's a bit of speculation that sometimes is needed just to create new hypotheses, not conclusions. Because if you don't know the answer of why the data is like this, what you say is the data is like this. Why? What if it's because of that? Mm-hmm. That requires imagination too.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's just people are very uncomfortable with how biased and uncontrollable this actually is, because then mm-hmm. all of us will have different imagination. Mm-hmm. You cannot put a grade on that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You cannot control that.
It's very difficult. Yeah.
It will depend on the impressions you have of nature, where you grew up, what books you read, what hikes you did as a kid. All of that will kind of shape your work, and people just have to accept. Yeah.
So do you think that scientists should be engaging in a lot of other activities, like reading books and going on hikes or listening to organ music?
Yeah.
Do you think that, you know, encouraging scientists to do that helps them have a more, remove some of the bias maybe of the way they interpret and give them new experiences that they can then take as they're, you know, in the creation stage and the hypothesis stage?
Yes, I think so. I mean, Americans even thought of that first. That's why you have arts and sciences together, right?
Right.
We in Europe, we don't have that. It's usually School of Arts and School of Science. I think someone before has already thought how they are they should be connected in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's the realm of creation. We are creating, right? What is a material engineer? Mm-hmm. It's an artist. Yeah. They are drawing new things. They mm-hmm. are creating new instruments. Yeah. Obviously, there's a functionality for that, but there's different types of drawing art, right? It mm-hmm. doesn't have to be abstract. It doesn't have all to be. I'm awful in all of them, to be honest. I know a lot of scientists that are artists as well,
right.
That do music, that I don't know which part of the brains you use for that, if there's any connection. Brain for me is a complete black box. I don't know any of all those classes of neurobiology, I was like, please kill me. Please take me away from this.
Well, if you're a bacteria, you don't need it. You That's already right. have everything.
But
you
if
need.
You have a background in biology, they will make you suffer through all the yes, things biology, true. Including immune system, including all the human things. And I know.
Yeah. I'm with you. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I salute people that like it. Oh, I will want a doctor one day to save my life. Yes. But
for sure.
It doesn't have to be me.
But okay, since we're on this.
Oh boy.
Hear me out. Hear me out.
I never know what you're going to say.
Yeah. I feel like our brain is basically a parasite.
Well, sure.
Metabolically speaking,
yes.
All it's doing is eating our food. It's not producing any food.
No.
Right? And meanwhile, it's convincing us that it is the most important organ in the body.
I'm going to blow your mind now.
Okay.
Did you know the brain was the only organ that named themselves?
Oh, my God.
And then they're kind of scumbags. I don't know if you can say this word.
Yes,
is it okay?
Yeah.
They are kind of meanie because then for the other organs they don't like, they're like blather.
Bladder.
Bladder. I'll be brain and you'll be bladder.
You'll be butt.
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah, good. We agree. Yeah. I love this.
This is just another case for why bacteria are superior to humans in every way.
Isn't it very convincing? Like, it's very, I agree with you. It just fits so right that the brain is the one making us decide which is the important organ.
Right.
Yeah. You, heart, you are feelings and things that are not objective.
Silly.
Yeah.
That intestine is just there to.
Yeah.
I do
nothing good comes out of it.
No, let's think even further.
Yeah.
Maybe it's bacteria making us think is the brain so that we don't look at the gut as the real brain.
I love it.
And they keep it as a secret. They are the ones running the show.
I totally buy it.
We have discovered something.
I think so. Let's write a paper.
Let's write a paper.
Let's write a paper. Okay, very good. I have a question.
Okay, go ahead.
And I actually want to go back to that really cool question that a child would ask. You know, like, why are plants green? And, you know, we know from science that plants are green because they have a pigment, it's chlorophyll, and they use it to absorb light and do photosynthesis, which
But why is that pigment green?
Why is the pigment... And you study pigments, in fact, and you study pigments from all kinds of different organisms. And it turns out that not everything is green. So my basic question is, why do living things need pigments in the first place? And why do we have so many of them?
That's a great question. So we can only use very sophisticated organisms to study that, which is all the organisms that exist now. They already passed through billions of years of evolution. So that's already an outcome of years of evolution. But looking at those diverse organisms that have pigments, we can reach a conclusion that it looks like pigments are here to protect us.
Mm-hmm.
We see it in plants and we think that's how they eat, right? That's how they absorb energy. Yeah. And that's true. But the majority of pigments, of the diversity of pigments, are actually here to help us. To help us protect against radiation, dryness, lack of resources. Flamingos produce it to mate.
Mm-hmm.
Or they eat krill
They
for
eat
that.
The krill, yeah.
But, so the pinkest flamingo will attract... the best female flamingo. Frogs, those frogs in Amazonic, they are very beautiful. Yes. But you touch them, you're dead.
Yes.
So they're also there to protect against for competition, basically. So lack of resources is a way to compete. Then you have plants that do it for thriving. If you think about it, we also use pigments in our life to basically show our allegiances.
Mm-hmm.
Flags,
yes.
The uniform of the football team.
Mm.
Yeah. Basically, we use biopigments to survive in all senses.
Right.
And there is a theory that the first life forms would have biopigments, but instead of in the visible, in the UV.
UV. So they absorb?
They would absorb UV. And this is just one theory from a study. It's not consensual. And we don't even think about pigments in the origin of life. People kind of overlook biopigments, to be honest, in all realms. But there is this one theory that said that. And the idea was that that would be a good way to channel energy for creating first cells and surviving on early Earth, which was not very adaptable. Mm-hmm. You think about an alien planet, that's early Earth.
Right. Mm-hmm. So lots of radiation,
a lot
toxic
of radiation.
Gases,
no oxygen. Right. Yes. Yeah. If you go on the time machine back in time, you'll just die.
You die. Excellent. Excellent. All right.
And if you take all the, like a Noah's Ark type of thing, you'll just kill everything. That's crazy. Most likely before the great oxygenic event, which was when cyanobacteria, so oxygenic photosynthesis came to be, it started raising oxygen to the atmosphere. When plants evolved, it reached the level that we have now, which is very recent. Throughout the history of oxygen also, it started with 1%, then 10%. So now to reach this 20% limit, it took a lot of years.
Right.
Before that, photosynthesis wasn't green, most likely. Because the organisms that do green photosynthesis are mainly oxygenic photosynthesis.
They produce oxygen. So by oxygenic, you mean they're producing oxygen as a waste product.
Exactly. Their waste product is oxygen, and we love that waste. We breathe it.
Right.
And the biopigment that produces, that help biological mechanisms, all the photosynthesis enabled by chlorophylls, which is the green pigment. So before this happened, there was already photosynthesis, but it wasn't oxygenic. It was anoxygenic photosynthesis. So photosynthesis that does not produce oxygen. They produce many other things, but not oxygen. And the biopigment in these organisms, and I'm talking about purple sulfur bacteria, purple non-sulfur bacteria, and green sulfur and non-sulfur bacteria as well. But usually those are a bit deeper in the lakes. But in any case, it might be that Earth was purple before, before the great oxygenic event.
I like that.
I like that as well. I think asked my son last night about, I was telling him about your work, and I asked him, what color are aliens? He's like, green. What if they were a different color? And he guessed purple.
Great instinct.
He's like, well, because when I see pictures of DNA, they usually have like green and purple. So I figured if it wasn't green, it was purple. I'm like, okay, I don't know that logic, but
it's great logic.
Yeah, yeah. I read some of the articles about this research that you've done and this idea, and I was like, it's not something I would have ever considered, even though I kind of know all that information. I know about purple bacteria and things like that. And it's, again, back to the idea of imagination. It's, what if this was actually what it was like? And then you can start to visualize it and then think about experiments you could do to prove it. And I think it's just I think your work is a really beautiful example of how the scientific method should be applied. And it was... so beautiful, so cool. And then on top of that, colors, which are, you know, beautiful. In your talk today that we attended, you showed some pictures of colors in ice, which most people don't really think that there's anything in ice to begin with, let alone these really beautiful pigments that you were able to extract. Can you talk a little bit about your actual work you do in ice here on Earth to better understand the pigmentation and potential planet life?
Yeah, so one of the conclusions of my work in the Arctic, and I do field work in the Arctic, was that the ice is much more enriched in pigmented bacteria than the subsurface water. So these ice sheets are on top of water, and if you do surveys on the microorganisms that is in the water versus that ice, the ice, it looks like there's a selective pressure against organisms that do not produce biopigments. And the reason for that, we believe, is because the ice surface is much more exposed to radiation and dryness. Because ice is itself a desert.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of water, but it's not available.
No.
It is frozen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it is dry. It is very dry. So these organisms have to survive high salinity, sometimes with dryness, with radiation. Biopigments are kind of a way to protect against all of these things at the same time. So what I do is I sample these environmental samples like ice. I sample water, places where I know there might be colorful organisms, and then I bring them to the lab and I grow it and I enrich it to see the real colors if they were in the dominant state in that environment. Because the ice here on Earth, it's pretty transparent.
Mm-hmm.
It's becoming more green, but it is still pretty transparent. We still have this inhospitable look of how the Arctic is. But it holds all these colors. They are just fighting with each other, and they don't let anybody shine. They don't. Mm-hmm. The organisms are fighting in competition, and they don't let one dominate. If that one dominates, then the colors will be brought up in that ice. We see this in Sierra Nevada, in the snow, where the snow sometimes becomes dark red or even pink.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's because one of the microalgae there is just dominating. That happens for a few days. It's not like a dominant state here on Earth. But what about other planets? It might actually be the rule.
Wow.
So the like the poles in other exoplanets may actually be purple or pink or red, and not like we have it here. And so afterwards, I bring it to the lab and grow them, and then I measure them through spectroscopy. Which is the language of astronomers. If you bring them DNA, they'll be like, what can I do with this? I have a telescope. I don't think we can sequence. I try to translate all this biology into astronomy language, which is spectra, which is what we can do with telescopes, is spectroscopy.
And looking at just colors, basically colors that bounce back.
Exactly. Right, the light bounces back to you, to the telescope, and you will be able to see them in the surface of planets, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And right now, you already can characterize the atmosphere.
Wow.
We are starting to characterize with James Webb Telescope. Mm-hmm. So this is one part of my work. The second part is when I bring the instrument with me. Through customs and through airports.
The pain in her voice, I could just hear it.
Those are the days that I think, why? Anyway, and sometimes it was my bag.
Oh, no.
Anyway, I'm not going to call the names of the airlines. But you know who you are. And sometimes I bring the instruments with me and I do in situ measurements. Mm. Because sometimes even in, like I mentioned Sierra Nevada, you have the pink snow. You have that in other snowy places. Uh-huh. In glaciers, there's so many colors in the surface. People think it's just completely transparent, but it's not. You have yellow, you have brown. Especially if there are pools of water, the surroundings, you're going to have a lot of watermelon snow, a lot of different algae coloring the surface. And so I try to get all those albedos, we call them, all those reflectance in the surface. And I'm basically chasing the colors and cataloging them and measuring them in high quality so that we can build models bottom up of planets with these different biopigments. And then you ask, okay, but there's so many. This is multivariate. But that's the thing. That's why biologists need to be working with astronomers. Mm-hmm. We can narrow down the list, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not expecting melanin on a planet that doesn't have radiation, right? That's why we produce melanin, right? We go to the beach, we become darker. And because the pigment is oxidized and irradiated and is there to protect us. East also have the same biopigment.
Yeah.
Because
that's cool.
They converged in the evolution to have to produce it because they also are exposed to radiation. And so it's basically a signature of an environment. Mm-hmm. So if you are looking for an irradiated planet, look for melanin or carotenoids, the type of biopigment also that that protects biota microorganisms from photooxidative stress. If you have a lot of infrared light coming from a star, so the majority of the stars in our galaxy are not sun-like. Dun, dun, dun.
they don't give off the same light as the sun. So we can't expect life to be the same on those planets.
Exactly. The majority of the stars in our galaxy are cool red stars. They are called M stars. They are smaller. Mm-hmm. And their peak of energy is in the infrared. Mm-hmm. So around 1,200 nanometers instead, as opposed to 500 and 600 as the G stars, the sun-like stars. Those are very nice stars to find planets like Earth because they're small. And it means that you're going to have a good contrast if you find Earth-like planets because they are not obfuscating the planet. They are small enough that the contrast is not, project ruining as some sun-like stars. They just obfuscate the planets if they're small. And Earth-like planets usually are small. Another important thing is that sun-like planets or bigger sun-like stars. Oh my God! But after five, or bigger stars, they tend to have Jupiters close by.
Yeah.
So at least the ones we observe. And that's because Jupiters migrate. Mm-hmm. And so they become hot Jupiters. Mm. Now, when they migrate, they will not leave the small planets alone. They will just eat them.
Eat them up, right. Yeah. Because so by Jupiters, you mean just big, giant planets.
Giant, we call it, yeah. And astronomers are so good with names. Uh-huh. Jupiters, they will call it. That's their taxonomy. And when they have to put a name, they'll call the name of the star plus A, B, C, or D, depending on how far away they are. Oh. That's why the first planet around an Earth-like, a Sun-like star is called 51 Pegasi B.
B.
Because the star is 51 Pegasi A. And then the second planet afterwards will be 51 Pegasi C.
Wow.
And that's how we do it. And now imagine there's a 51 Pegasi. That's amazing. But usually it's HR220001 A. HR2C0001 B. And that's the name of a planet.
Yeah, it seems like astronomers aren't as creative as biologists in naming things.
Absolutely not.
I mean, there's a protein called makes caterpillars floppy.
That's right.
Look, there's a gene sequence called GAGA. Like
perfect.
Lady Gaga.
Perfect.
So yeah, biologists, we have, I think we have a little bit more
than
fun.
Physicists. Yeah,
sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw a bumper sticker once that said, flirt harder, I'm a physicist.
That's accurate.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're
all
great.
All you physicists out there, I'm not even going to apologize because you know I'm right.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay. All right.
Love you,
but, you know, but, yeah.
Improve the planet names, please. It's hard to get money for projects if we are like, please get excited about H1922B.
Yeah, you guys have a marketing problem.
This is a serious marketing problem. Anyway, going back to the red stars, it was my fault. It was definitely
perfect.
My fault.
This is perfect.
So G stars will have the hot Jupiters, or other big stars will usually have those hot Jupiters, and then meaning it's hard to find those Earth-like planets. So M stars actually are very enriched in these Earth-like planets. The problem is the models people were using for the surface were chlorophyll green plant models.
Right.
And it's just not going to work because
yeah.
you don't have the visible energy fueling
right.
photosynthesis.
Yeah.
So if only we had photosynthesis that is fueled in the dark.
Mm.
But we do. Mm-hmm. And we were not looking at it.
Yeah.
Green and purple sulfur bacteria, they are fueled. Their photosynthesis is fueled by heat.
Wow.
By infrared light.
Yeah.
Just like
yeah.
an M star would give. Yeah. Actually, there was one of these organisms, the green sulfur bacteria, that was found in the hydrothermal vent.
Mm.
Where there's no light, no sunlight.
So this
there's
is
just
very
heat.
Deep in the ocean where there's just
very
stuff
deep.
Spewing out of
exactly.
the Earth. Right.
Very deep in the ocean, but a very hot spot. It's a volcanism type, deep ocean volcanism event. They are just surviving on this heat. And now a lot of high-throughput metagenomics is also finding a lot of bacterial chlorophylls there, which is the pigment of these dark photosynthesis, let's call it that. And people used to think it was contamination, but no, it's truth.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's the idea here is that, you know, I really like what you said, that biopigments are a signature of the environment.
Exactly.
So something that grows deep in the ocean is going to have a different pigment than something that grows in, you know, my garden. Than
yep.
something that grows on a planet far, far away.
And so you cannot be just modeling your garden.
Yeah.
Do not model your garden. We don't want to planet. We don't want just garden planets.
No. But I've always wanted to do this with my kids, and I've done it several times throughout my scientific training, is making the Winogradsky columns where people can actually visualize. I know. You can see there are purple and green bacteria growing probably pretty close to your backyard. You can go pull some stuff out of a pond or some wet water.
Can you explain the column and how it works?
You're basically creating a planet.
Yeah.
You're creating a closed
she's
system.
She's going to explain that.
Really. Oh, yeah. Explain. Yeah.
No, sorry. I love Winogradsky
cool.
column.
Okay, yeah. Then you take it away.
So Winogradsky column is the equivalent of a Petri dish for environmental microbiologists. So a clinical microbiologist will use Petri dishes.
Mm-hmm.
Where you have your pure culture, everything's very clean and, you know, no contaminations. While ecologists or microbial ecologists, they need to really study the whole environment as all the variables are important to study the biota there. It's all about representation. And so there's this scientist, Winogradsky, that created this method where you put some carbon and calcium inputs. It could be eggshells. Mm-hmm. It could be whatever you want. Mm-hmm. And then you go to get a sample from the environment. It can be sediment from a lake, from soil, your backyard, if you're really into that. and you put on top. And basically, it can be even water from a lake. You close it. Mm-hmm. Or you close it completely shut, or you close it just a little bit to add some oxygen to circulate. You put in front of light. You put in front of red light. You put some stickers on, whatever you want. And whatever, it's going to just create a whole ecosystem there.
Wow.
And it can survive forever.
Mm-hmm. That's in theory. Super cool.
So I'm actually going to say something here in the podcast that is very personal. I'm going to get married very soon. Hopefully.
Congratulations.
And one of the things I want to do in my wedding is everybody will create a Winogradsky column. Oh and
my
say
gosh, you're so cool.
As their, as their souvenir. Because then it's something that lasts forever.
Right.
Yeah.
And you can just put it on your... so it's going to smell a bit on the first days because of sulfur. But then that goes away. Or you just become immune to it.
Yeah. Nose blind. Yeah.
But basically, it's your own planet that you keep on your living room.
That's so cool.
You can see the colors.
It's changing, So you'll see everybody will have a different one depending on what they sampled. It can become very purple because of purple bacteria, very green, very orange because of iron oxidation. It can become very green, dark green, whatever. It is growing. It will. You can never predict life. You can never predict how it's going to turn out, because it depends on the input. If you put more egg than I did, if actually you catch more of the biota, which dominant organisms that actually will eat that egg or not. If you put yeast extract, whatever it is, it will create such different planets. It's amazing.
Yeah. That sounds like such.
I have a pet
idea.
One.
Yeah.
I need to start one from my backyard. And in the notes of the podcast, maybe we'll leave some instructions for people make
good
their
idea.
Own.
Good
yes,
idea.
That's true.
I think that'd
very
be
good.
Really cool.
Yes, let's do that.
My PhD advisor has several in his office as well from places he's grabbed stuff all. I don't know how he gets stuff back into the U.S. or whatever, but he's got stuff from all over.
I think I'm going to sample my teenage kid's room, and then we're all going to die.
That's a clinical microbiology problem. Yeah.
I don't think that's going to work, but you can definitely try. Prove me wrong. It would be interesting.
We'll see.
So carotenoids are also what carrots produce.
Yeah, right. So the oranges and reds and things like that.
Oh, yeah, exactly. You can also have them in your skin if you eat a lot of oranges and then get exposed by the sun to the sun. I'm not encouraging anybody to do this again, but it's totally reversible if you want to, and it's a good prank. Actually, the tanning products that we buy, they are full of these carotenoids. That's how it works. That's why you become orange. They just put a lot of carotenoids, and they know the moment you have exposure of the sun, they're going to get oxidized and become more orange.
More orange.
So you have like this reversible deposit of carotenoids on you.
Fun facts. The more you know.
Yeah.
The more you know.
But that's hypothetical.
The more orange you get. I don't know anybody who's orange. Zero people. Okay.
All right. I want to talk about one more thing as we wrap up our time here. You do a lot of work with civic engagement and science as well. And I, again, was just reading a little bit about some of that. And I thought it was so cool. One of the big things you've done recently is work to get menstrual products up into outer space for people who need them when they're up on a rocket ship.
And doing work.
I mean, it's hard enough to need those products on a day-to-day basis here, let alone when you are in outer space. And, you know, things don't behave the same in outer space as they do here, so it's important to test those types of things. And can you talk a little bit about why you think it's important for scientists to be participating in these types of endeavors, and a little bit about the work that you specifically do?
Oh, yeah. So there's things outside of my work that I'm passionate about, causes that I think things that have to change. And I'm not a politician. I'm always saying this. I don't create policies. I'm not interested in being a politician. The only contribution I give to society is data, and trying to give some interpretation of this data. And so there's what I try to do, and I try to leverage also my privilege access to space, because as astronomers, we have a privilege access to space. We know which calls are going to be open. We know the people that run them. We know where money is for these types of things. And I write projects where we can test medical devices for women in space. Because they are understudied. They are understudied on Earth. And this is a bad habit we are just bringing to space with us. This is actually something that was widely studied in the Antarctica, how gear for women in field work is just not tailored. It's just we are using men's stuff. We go on the speedboat. I did that in the Arctic. It was terrifying. I was even more terrified of the speedboat than on the of the polar bears, which was we have to put these water suits. There are the size small. It's a Scandinavian man small. Okay, it's not a Mediterranean woman small. And so you are like in these vests that is just constraining vests. On a speedboat in a fjord full of icebergs that is changing in the air. It's half the time in the air than in the water.
Wow.
And it's terrifying.
Yeah.
Again, why can't I have the same comfort? And we are bringing this to the to space. Right now, women in space have their menstruation hormonally suppressed, which can work for some of them. But I'm sure some of them are not happy with this.
Right.
Just by statistics, right?
Yeah.
And currently, they may be not happy with it for 6 months. And in the future, they're going to have to endure it on Mars or in a colony in the moon for years. So we are going to reach a position where we're gonna, we are asking the the male astronauts, oh, do you want to do this job for 5 years? And they're fine. And to a woman astronaut, oh, do you want to do this job going to Mars for 5 years? And by the way, you're going to have to put your reproductive system on hold for 20 years. Right, it does not make sense. It's not the same job requirements, right? It's not fair. And the only thing we actually have to do is repurpose what we already created on Earth, like menstrual cups, menstrual pants. Astronauts change their okay, I always say this is wrong. They change their underwear every day. That's normal. We all do that. What I mean is that they dispose of their underwear every day. They don't reuse the same underwear. So what is the problem with the menstrual pants?
Right.
Why can't just they have that? It doesn't work for all the women, but what we want to provide, what I want to provide, and me and I'm working with a group on this. It's a group, an amazing group in Portugal of aerospace engineers and another astrobiologist that works on the communication, because the communication part is very important so that people start talking about this. And what we want to do is basically create options. We just want women in space to have options. And we are not even inventing the medical devices. We are just testing if they endure space. People haven't done that before. It started also because I went to a space agency for a summer school 6 years or 5 years ago. And they were talking, I'm not going to name the space agency. they were talking about how it's a big effort to bring women to space because their reproductive organs are so radio sensitive, which is again based on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So I would also go back and study that a bit better.
That's understudied, for sure.
That's a bit, jumpy in conclusions, in my opinion. But anyway, and they have a big disposable problem with menstruation. And I was like, why? Because menstrual pads and tampons, they take a lot of space in cargo, and we have a disposable problem. I'm like, what about menstrual cups and menstrual pants? And they answered, menstrual what?
I have no idea.
And I'm like, menstrual cups exist for, menstrual pants fair, but menstrual cups exist like for 20 years now. There's no, this is completely unacceptable. What is constraining technology? You are building robot surgeons, like we are building hologram doctors. This is completely unacceptable. The fact that we don't have this technology just because you don't talk about it on coffee break. That's the reason.
Yes, and it's really about the awareness, because as men, we don't think about these things.
And that's fair.
We need
to
be told.
And that's fair.
We need to learn more about it.
Learn
more about it. It's the correct part. It is fair.
And that's why that's why I think it's important to talk about it on a podcast.
Perfect.
And
it's perfect.
You know, I think I want to give a lot of benefit of the doubt to men in science.
Of course.
Or that, you know, yeah. if you
Oh, I'm not saying there's no sexism.
No,
out there.
I know that. I know that.
That's not what I'm saying at all. But there's also a lot of ignorance.
Yeah, yes.
A whole lot of ignorance. Yeah. That's why it's amazing that you're doing this.
Yeah, and I think, you know, something like getting your period in space, you know, that's a shameful thing
yeah.
for women to even kind of bring up and say, no, I need, this would be great for me.
Yeah.
To even talk about it. So
yeah.
seeing that you doing this work not only brings awareness to women in STEM fields, and we were talking about even your field work, some of the limitations of either equipment and using the restroom and all that kind of stuff, that men and women just have different experiences
mm-hmm.
In science in general. And so I think talking about it and doing work, even if it's just testing to see if these menstrual products work in outer space, which is a crazy thought to begin with.
Yeah.
I think it's really cool and really important.
And actually, just to make this clear, the team is half men and half women,
yeah.
this team of the Menstrual Cup.
Yeah.
We are called Astro Cup.
I love it. yeah.
And it's as important, like the moment we bring this up, men are like, oh, of course, we need to.
Yeah.
Like this is,
yeah.
It's not a gender situation. Like I don't believe it's that men don't care. It's because naturally they wouldn't think about it.
Yeah.
But also it's the lack, it's the taboo around it that makes us not talk about it for them to learn about it.
Yeah.
Also, the lack of women in the room in before
about,
time.
Yeah,
there was no women in the room on those conversations back in the day
yeah.
when they were creating these missions and talking about discussing men missions. You see those photos of the doctors, of the astronaut doctors. It's mainly men.
Yeah.
Now it's changing. So, you know, all of these things will make it better. But at the same time, right now, they are already in space and not menstruating. So things yeah. have to go a bit yeah. faster.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really awesome that you're doing this kind of work outside of your extensive postdoc research. I mean, I can't imagine how much time. You were just in Greenland this summer as well doing field work, which I wish we had more time to talk about it here. But people can find your work online and some of these, you know, articles and news stories about the purple aliens and things like that, and read about your civic engagement efforts as well on your website, which is just yournamecom.
Did you yes.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough it was still available.
Yeah. yeah. So you've got a lot of cool things on there as well that people will post.
We'll post some things on our website too.
Before we say goodbye, is there anything that you didn't get to say that you wish listeners could hear? Like your just one thing about outer space or microbiology that you just want people to know before we leave?
Yes, I think I would just like to highlight how everybody is needed in space.
Mm.
If you're a lawyer, we need you. If you're a doctor, we need you. If you are a marketing person, we need you. We need every single person. If we are to become spacefaring, we need you to take an interest in space and bring your knowledge. If we try to put a Mars rover in Mars, we need people with a law, they have to understand yeah. about policies. We need every single person that has very different knowledges and professions to actually work together.
Mm.
So there's ways for you to learn about space. There's a lot of outreach out there. And I would especially seek out outreach which allow you to be part of a simulation to create a space mission.
Mm.
And you'll see how your hat is needed as mm-hmm. well. You don't need to change fields. You just need to do what you do best. We need what you do mm. best. And so basically that's the idea I would like to leave in this podcast.
I think that's beautiful.
That's wonderful.
I didn't know what you would say, but I think that is really, really cool and a really beautiful thing to leave people with.
Absolutely.
So, we need you.
We need you.
So thank you so much for agreeing to do this interview with us today. It has been an absolute delight and it is now after 6. So we are going to let you go and we hope next time you're in South Bend, you'll come back and do another interview.
Oh, that would be lovely. Thank
awesome.
You so much.
Thank you so much.
At the end of our show, we would like to thank you, our lovely listeners, and our awesome audience for spending your time with us. We thank the Notre Dame College of Science and the Indiana University South Bend College of Arts and Sciences. Special thanks to the wonderful people at the Notre Dame Studios. Coming to you from beautiful South Bend, Indiana, in the heart of the Rust Belt, this is Rust Belt Science. I'm Shahir Risk.
And I'm Maggie Fink.
And we'll catch you next time.